Hello, everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. And in a moment, I'm going to bring on our very special guest, Brett Mitchell. And before we do, as you gather, I've got something I wanted to play for you here today. So we'll get this going. Hey, Brett, that was beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And for our audience, just so they know, you're the music director of the Colorado Symphony since 2017. You've had Renee Fleming, Yo-Yo Ma, Itzhak Perlman. You were at the Cleveland Orchestra, the Houston Symphony. You were born in Seattle. You've been a guest on our podcast before. It's so great to have you. Welcome, and tell us why you picked that particular piece by none other than John Williams.
Yeah, well, it's great to be with all of you today, and thank you for having me back, Jim. That piece I recorded, I think at the end of May, maybe beginning of June, when all of the racial reckoning after George Floyd's murder was happening. And I'm a conductor by trade. As Jan mentioned, I'm the music director of the Colorado Symphony. And right now, orchestras are not able to perform for obvious reasons, which means that what I would ordinarily do, which is try to kind of lend my voice to things that matter, see what I can contribute artistically to what's going on in society, ordinarily, I would do that via the medium that I've made my career in for the last 20, 25 years, which is orchestral music. There is no orchestral music right now. But I was always, I try to make a distinction between being a pianist, which I am not, and a piano player, which I am. A pianist is somebody that makes their living doing it. A piano player is somebody that knows where all the keys are, and that's me. But when I was thinking about what I might be able to do to offer some comfort and some solace and all of that during what was and continues to be a very difficult time, I thought, why don't I sit down at the piano and record this really extraordinarily beautiful piece by John Williams from his collaboration with Steven Spielberg in 2012. About Abraham Lincoln. The movie was called Lincoln. And that little piece is called With Malice Toward None, a line from one of Mr. Lincoln's great speeches, of course. And so while it was definitely out of my comfort zone, listen, I don't play piano publicly. That's not really what I do. I'm a conductor. And so while it was out of my comfort zone, it was also the only way that I could, oh, sure, I can sit there and look at the camera and say words and all of that. But we have plenty of words right now, and we certainly don't have a lack of people willing to say them into a camera. But what we do need, I think, is the comfort and the solace that art offers. And if I'm not able to do it in the way that I normally do it, then I need to find a way to adapt. I need to be resilient, and I need to be able to reinvent myself. And so that little recording is one of a number of recordings that I've made. And I have a whole big, long schedule of things to record right now while orchestras are not at it as we usually are. So that was kind of the impetus for getting that started.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I can't help but remember one of the things we talked about when we first met was we noticed when we spoke to you, there was a whole bookshelf of books behind you, and a lot of those were on leadership. Mm-hmm. You talked about music being the vessel, but the real job of the conductor is to bring a team together to lead. Mm-hmm. And here you are now without a team to lead, so to speak. That's so right. And before we went on, you were talking about there's a little bit of grieving going on. And I don't think it's just with artists, but I think with a lot of people that probably can relate, even if they're not an artist. Tell us kind of, you know, 6 months is a long time. What have you experienced?
Well, it's been an interesting 6 months, just as it has for everybody. You know, when this all happened, I was in San Antonio conducting the San Antonio Symphony. And I had my first rehearsal with them on Wednesday, March 11th. We had two more on Thursday, March 12th. We had the dress rehearsal on the morning of Friday, March 13th. And after the dress rehearsal, the concerts were canceled that were supposed to be that night and the next night. And I ended up flying home to Denver, which is where I am now. And it was one of those things, I think we all felt like, okay, is this 4 weeks? Is this 6 weeks? Is this two? What are we doing here? Yeah. And so there wasn't a clear kind of path to follow. And so I think the first part of it for me, I mean, this really is about the stages of grief. The first part is denial, because you can't even imagine what's happening right now. I mean, I conduct dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of concerts every single year. And I have not conducted a concert now in 5.5 months, almost 6 months. And that's just like unimaginable to me that I, you know, that I've been doing this thing for decades and decades. And the way that I choose to make music is with other people. And that is taken away right now. But the thing that really turned me around in this stay at home, my wife Angela and I were having a conversation. And it was actually about the leadership talk that that I gave a few years ago that you asked me to give in November of 2017. And one of the things that I say in that talk is how important it is to understand your core purpose. Mm-hmm. And for me, my core purpose, as I articulated back then and will articulate for you again right now, is to share music I love with as many people as possible. And as Angela said to me, where in that does it say anything about conducting? Where in that does that say anything about orchestra? And it doesn't. It just says to share the music I love with as many people as possible. And those are my words. That's my mission statement. And so it really caused me to step back and think, because I was, you know, I was kind of, you know, kvetching about not being able to conduct. It's like, man, this is how I make music. And, you know, as you can probably see, there's a piano right behind me, right there.
Yeah.
And so Angela said, doesn't say anything about conducting, doesn't say anything about orchestras. It says only about sharing the music you love with as many people as possible. Well, sharing anything today is easy because it's 2020, even whether you're home. Home or out and about. And the music I love is very wide ranging. You know, I didn't grow up listening to classical music first. I grew up listening to, first was John Williams music, you know, because I was I was born in 1979, so it was Star Wars and Superman and E.T. and Raiders and all of that great stuff. And then my second love was jazz. And so what, listen, nobody needs to hear me. This is why I make the distinction between being a piano player and a pianist. While I make my living conducting Mozart and Beethoven, that's a very different skill set than actually being able to technically execute all of that. Like, my ears and my brain are way far ahead of where my hands and fingers can be, because for the last 20 years I haven't been playing full time. I've been conducting. So nobody's like clamoring to hear me play a Mozart sonata, nor should they. But there are things that I can offer. Things like the piece from Lincoln that you just heard. So because I'm a big John Williams guy, and because I'm a big jazz guy, in addition to being a classical musician, I'm very happy to let my colleagues who are pianists play the Mozart and the Beethoven and all of that from home. But one thing that I can do that perhaps your everyday run-of-the-mill pianist can't is sit there and look at an entire orchestral score on, as I sit at the piano, and then see if I can take all of those different parts and put them in my fingers, put them in my hands, and can I get the piano to sound like an orchestra? Can I get close? Can I approximate? Now, the piece you just heard is actually a piano piece. That's a real piano piece that John wrote for that thing. But there's a couple of others that I've put up. Beautiful scene from Angela's Ashes, a film he did in 1999, that starts as a piano thing but then goes into an orchestral thing. Born on the 4th of July, which is just orchestral. But I've arranged all of those things at the piano because it's a way to, it's a way for me to be creative, which is nice. But it's a way for me to share music that I love with people in a way that's different from the way that I ordinarily do it. And once I got past the denial and the grieving stage of all of that and said, okay, put on your big boy pants and settle down and focus. What is the goal and how do we get there? And that's all about adaptability right now.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Brett, you said share the music I love so that, fill it in.
Wow, that's great, Jim. So that, So here's the very straightforward answer. I tried to come up with something more clever, but here's a straightforward answer. Share music I love so that the people that I share it with might love it too.
Yeah.
That's really all it is. And there's, you know, I say love, but music affects you in a lot of ways. Share music that moves me, share music that, you know, whatever. But that's really ultimately what it's about. Is I don't have any problem in the world with people hearing a piece that I play either at the piano or with an orchestra and saying, not really for me. I don't have any problem with that in the world. But what I love doing is I love giving people the opportunity to open the door, whether or not they walk through or not is up to them. Maybe they see what's on the other side of the door and they're like, it's all right, don't need it. But it's really about giving other people the opportunity to fall in love. I'm paid to fall in love every day, and I would love for other people to have that too.
Yeah. I like the expression of, you know, moving, because, you know, the MTV Awards were last night and somebody was quoted as saying, you know, music can bring us together and it's a universal language, all those things. But it is interesting how different types of music move people, different people in different ways at different times. And one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you is because of so many of the parallels between what you do and what leaders that in the business world are trying to do today. You describe a score of all these different parts. And I don't know if people know how complex it is to be able to see all these different parts. And as a conductor, you're looking around trying to figure out how it all comes together. And every CEO running a business these days is basically trying to do the same thing as a score. Don't you think?
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's, it's really a perfect parallel because you know, the details of the music, you know, what, like, I'll give you an example. Let's say the first trumpet player has a B flat. Okay. Well, there's nothing I can do to make the trumpet player hit the B flat. They're either going to hit the B flat or they're not. My job is to make sure that if they do hit the B flat, that it makes sense in context, that everything around it is glued to that B flat, so that everything is of a piece. And so because I can't directly influence the little teeny tiny things, I need to know the little teeny tiny things, certainly, of course. But what I'm really responsible for is the big picture, the 30,000 foot view. It's right. Really easy to get micromanagey with your musicians, with your employees, with whomever. But I've found that it's so much easier. Yes, you're the one that has the score, of course. And you're trying to get everybody on the same page, for sure. But it's, you know, the ironic thing about all, maybe not the ironic thing, but the revealing thing about that is that the only way that a conductor can do that is by listening, not by talking. You can only get there by listening. You have to talk to be able to affect the change, but you can't affect change unless you've actually heard what's going on.
Oh, such a great point. I remember, I'm gonna pop a question up here from somebody that's listening, but I remember in one of our earlier conversations, you talked about how you might, as you're conducting in a rehearsal, hear 14 things that are wrong.
Right.
You remember it? Do you remember the rest of the story?
Yeah, of course. And this was when I was at the Houston Symphony, it was our principal trombonist, Alan Barnhill, who taught me this lesson. He said, you know, in every rehearsal or every little section of a rehearsal or whatever, it's going to be 14 things that are going to go wrong. And your job is to find the three that won't fix themselves. And the implication, of course, is that 11 of those things will fix themselves because the musicians are professionals and they're listening too, and they can hear what's going on and all of that. So it's really about knowing which battles to pick. It's really about knowing what can I influence, what needs to be influenced, and what does not need to be influenced. So you take the things that need to be fixed, the things that don't need to be fixed, put those in two separate camps, and then of the things that need to be fixed, which of those are going to fix themselves? Because a lot of things will fix themselves. And our job as leaders is to have the foresight and to have the intuition to know which of those things are not going to fix themselves, the things that we have to deal with.
When I lead expeditions out in the wilderness, for usually it's about 4 days, we come out of the woods and all the executives who haven't been able to get to their phone, cell phone coverage didn't work, they get there and they're like, none of this mattered. It all took care of itself. Like, what am I doing every day getting involved in all this stuff? And again, I think your point about really listening, hearing the unheard, is what's so important. Let me pop up. Let me show a question we got from Lynn Harris. And Lynn, thanks for the question. Lovely piece, Brett. Seems like this is the best time for an outdoor event to continue doing what you love to do. What options do you think can be outside the box to conduct your orchestra rather than not?
Yeah, it's a great question. We are, the Colorado Symphony is doing some performances at Red Rocks right now, which is our big outdoor venue here in Denver. So Red Rocks, for those who aren't familiar, seats 9,500 people. And the performances that we've been doing, which have been led by our resident conductor, Christopher Dragon, instead of 9,500 people, we're seating 175 people so that it's all socially distanced. And I haven't been to any of those performances. I'm sure that they have been very well received. People are really clamoring for any kind of live music, right? Any kind of live anything right now. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly one way that we've been able to do that. There are some performances that are going on right now, actually, right by our concert hall in downtown Denver. It's part of a big performing arts complex. And so while the weather has been nice, and this is where we're going with all of this, of course, while the weather has been nice, we've had some of our musicians outdoors with socially distanced audiences. Again, we're talking like maybe 50 people. In terms of how we move forward, well, we're good for another month or so in Colorado. And, you know, you can say all you'd like about October and it can be nice and all of that. I'll just point out that during the last week of October last year, here at our house, which is in the foothills outside of Denver, we got just shy of 2 feet of snow on like October 20-something. So the outdoor opportunities are great for now, but in another month or so, we're going to have to figure something else out. And, you know, the other issue, since you were asking about orchestras and performing outside, is, you know, with string players, it's one thing. String players can have their masks on and all of that and be socially distanced. But for wind players, for brass players and all of that, they're blowing. They're literally blowing air through their instruments. And that means that while the string players need to be about 6 feet apart from each other, with masks. The brass and the winds need to be about 15 feet apart from each other. Now, a typical low brass section is three trombones and a tuba. That's four players who would need to be 60 feet apart if you put them in a line. So there are obviously issues here with who can perform. Like, as I mentioned, these performances at the Performing Arts Complex that have been going on this week are for cellists, because they're string musicians and they're not blowing into anything. So the outdoors is certainly one of the venues that we've been pursuing, and it's been the only way that we've really been able to do anything. The only time any of us have been back in our concert hall, which is called Betcher Concert Hall in downtown Denver, that shut down, I think probably March 13th, same time as everything else did. And then nine of our string players and I went into the concert hall like first week of June, second week of June, something like that, right around the time of the George Floyd murder. And we recorded a piece by an African-American composer named George Walker, a piece he wrote called Lyric for Strings. And this has been one of the other really interesting things, not to get too far afield here, but in addition to dealing with COVID, as everybody else is, my industry is also dealing with a real racial reckoning right now. There is a lack of diversity in our field. So one of the things that we've been trying to do at these outdoor performances or the video recording project that we did of George Walker's piece back in June, or with some of the projects that we have coming up, is also to just diversify our offerings more, because that's something that desperately needs to happen. But it's a great question, Lynn. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, let me, I think this brings up a great point. You talked a little bit about needing to be adaptable and resilient. I think most people can relate to that. It'd be interesting to know how many webinars there have been on resiliency. But, you know, I'm wondering more about the reinvention piece. You know, there, as we all know, I mean, there's jobs going away forever.
Yeah.
And jobs changing. And a lot of people say, well, this was all going to happen. It's just now been accelerated. Yeah. But all of us have a responsibility to really look at what we do and figure out, you know, different ways to you know, create that offering. I mean, is that something you've spent time doing and other musicians, and how might that relate, do you think, to, you know, everybody out there?
Well, I think this is really the crux of the matter, isn't it? The reinvention portion of things. There was, in my industry, in the classical music industry, on Saturday night, there was a pretty big bombshell to the industry, which is that one of the three big classical music agencies that represents, you know, conductors and violinists and sopranos and all the rest, is shutting down. And this was an agency that was founded 90 years ago, CAMI, Columbia Artist Management. And they represented Leonard Bernstein and Carrion, and they, it was like the biggest of the big. And they sent out an email to all of their artists on Saturday night saying, sorry, it's over. And, you know, they're going to, you know, do their best to get new, you know, representation at other places for all of these artists. But I mean, the, you talk about changes that were coming anyway. Too big to fail is one of the things that gets applied to places like Columbia Artist Management. And it was just such a behemoth that, you know, my manager, who is the greatest manager in the business, Linda Martyr, has her own boutique agency. She only represents maybe 20 artists total. On the CAMI roster, the Columbia Artist Management roster, they had something like, I don't know, dozens of conductors. I mean, hundreds of classical musicians. And that takes a lot of staff, takes a lot of people to manage all of those folks. And when you don't have any money coming in, like the classical music industry doesn't right now, well, all of that overhead doesn't go away. You still have to pay all of the staff. And it unfortunately just got to a point where they weren't able to do that anymore. Now, in some ways, the smaller agencies, the boutique agencies, are going to be able to navigate this a little bit more easily because they're a little more nimble, kind of like a little, little boat in the ocean compared to like an enormous ocean liner or something. But this reinvention that you're talking about is exactly what's going to happen it's going to have to happen for the whole world. Nothing's going to be the same. But certainly for classical music, you know, and again, for multiple reasons, things are going to look different because of COVID, and things are going to look different because of the racial reckoning that's been going on. And so the ability to, let me change that. We all have the ability to reinvent ourselves. The willingness to reinvent ourselves, I think, is what everybody, every classical musician that I know, every musician that I know, is either dealing with or going to be dealing with at a time that works for them. But this is, you know, so many, even our Colorado Symphony musicians, you know, it's easier for soloists because they have the resources and all of that because they tend to make more money. Orchestral musicians aren't rolling in it, let's say. And yet some of them have, John Pfeiffer, our principal trombone, is very good. Obviously, he's an incredible musician, but he's also very good with technology and recording himself and looping himself, you know, so that he can play with a recording of himself and, you know, layer on top of himself however many times. That's great because I always forget, as a pianist, I can make it sound like an orchestra all the time. A trombone is what we call a single line instrument. It just plays one note at a time. It goes up, it goes down. So John, while he prepared his entire, you know, throughout his schooling and his early career, he's not that old, I think he's younger than I am, he was preparing to be a trombonist in a professional symphony orchestra. He certainly was not preparing to sit at home, buy a whole bunch of new pedals and recording equipment and all of this stuff, and start churning out really great. I think he's done some covers and he's also done some original things. And it's like, what a waste it would be to only have John Pfeiffer play orchestral trombone. Who knew that he had that inside him? Who knew? Maybe John didn't even know that he had it inside him. And yet look what has come out, because he chose to adapt. He chose to be resilient. He's also, I think he and his wife Hitomi also have I think she's like a 2-year-old little girl. So that helps with resiliency from what I've been told as well. So.
Well, as we're kind of coming toward the end of our time together, I want to throw something over to you and see what you think. After 6 months, you know, what's been interesting for me is all my clients for the first time are going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so you know, and that's presented an interesting challenge to me because, again, I feel like I get to be a busy bee pollinating. I take the best ideas and I share, and everybody's sort of on the same thing. And one thing I've noticed a little bit, I'm calling it the trough of despair. That after 6 months, at the beginning, a lot of the leaders were like, this is, you know, this is, pandemic is terrible, but the challenge is awesome. You know, I love a challenge. This is, I get to do something different and I get to get off the road. I'm spending more time at home with the family. And now, you know, coinciding with fall and school and unknown and uncertainty with children, I'm finding a lot of people, whether they're in a trough of despair, they're around people that are. It's just like a low point. And this is where I'm wondering where you all fit in is, you know, this beautiful thing called music, you know, can move people. And we know that there's a mental health crisis going on as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, there's no way the capacity can meet the demand. Is there a way that, you know, artists like yourself can tap into that and help move and in a way change the mood of a country or the world by delivering the right music at the right time in the right way, despite all this? I know that's a crazy big ask. I'm just wondering.
No, it is. But I think listen, I wouldn't be in this field if I didn't believe in music's power to move people. I mean, listen, if it was just pretty, who the hell cares? I mean, yeah. It's great, and beauty is important. Ask John Keats. But there's so much more to it than just beauty. There's, you know, the thing that I love about music is the empathy that it can generate, even though there's no words. You know, if you sit there and you listen to a piece by Beethoven, for example, and you know. Whether you know his biography and know his history or not, you can hear that this is somebody that really struggles with it, that really engages with it, that doesn't shy away from it, that looks it right in the eye and tries to deal with it and tries to work it out. And even when Beethoven is at the depths of despair, the trough of despair, as you called it, he always manages to find a way to the other side of that, at least artistically. And there's something, as I say, the empathy of the thing, there's something about hearing Beethoven go through a thing, work through a thing, despair, grief, tragedy, whatever it is. Forget Beethoven, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, any of them. There's something about hearing those people in a time that seems so long ago and so foreign to us. Something about hearing those people have the same emotions, the same feelings, the same fears, the same desires, the same hopes that we do, that makes us feel less alone. That's what music for me is great for, is that even if I'm by myself listening to one other solo artist, it makes me feel less alone. And in some ways, the content of it is kind of secondary for me to the communication of the thing. Like the medium is the message, you know? Mm-hmm. It's something about the communal spirit of it. Even, and I know it's hard. Listen, I play shows for concert halls of 2,500 people all the time, and there is no replacing the energy that you get from 2,500 people. But that doesn't mean that musicians can't still communicate. In fact, we might be able to communicate even more intimately than we ever could before, because it's just us. It's just me at the piano and you listening, as opposed to me at the piano and you and 2,500 people listening. Now, 2,500 people are never going to listen to me play the piano, but you take my meaning. I think it's the empathy of it. It's a tall order, certainly, to be, could you fix the world with music, maestro? Well, surely, no problem at all. Happy to do it. But that is what I'm trying to do. It's what I've always tried to do. Just one piece at a time. Bring one more piece of beauty. Bring one more piece of empathetic art to somebody, you never ever know who you're going to touch. Just very briefly, Martin Katz, who was one of the gentlemen that I mentioned in that leadership talk that I gave, taught me a lot of really great things about leadership. And my wife did a masterclass with him like 2 or 3 months ago. This is 20 years after I worked with him. And so I took the opportunity to write him and to say, Martin, I just wanted you to know that you really impacted my life. I worked with him in a masterclass for 45 minutes 20 years ago. And I said, I even talk about you in this leadership talk that I give. And I sent him the video of his little portion and all of that. And he wrote back, and it was a really lovely email. And as it turns out, he had one more really great lesson to teach me, which is when he was playing all the time as a pianist with a very famous soprano in the boonies, as he said, you know, North Dakota or wherever, he said that she told him, you never know who is in that audience, and you never know who you are going to touch. You never know who you're going to move. And Martin Katz wouldn't have remembered me if he passed me 20 times on the street. But that 45 minutes, so what I told him was, the 45 minutes that you spent with me 20 years ago, even if we forget those 45 minutes the next week, they can stay with somebody else for decades. And music can do the same thing. So that's what I'm always trying to do.
Yeah. I love your comment about helping people feel less alone.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I find with the teams I work with, that most of them have an opportunity to seek support from each other in a much better way. Yeah. In other words, many of them will say, hey, if you need something, holler, I'm here. But they're less inclined to basically be the person to say, I need some help.
Yeah.
And when they do, they actually help the team and for a whole bunch of reasons. And recently, I'm going to ask a question for a student I'm working with right now.
Yep.
I told her about your quote that a great orchestra doesn't just play with each other. A great orchestra plays for each other. Okay. And she said, well, in my experience, you know, people are, you know, professional musicians come in, they do their piece, they get a paycheck, they leave. They it's a job.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say? You know.
Well, I mean, listen. A lot of that. There are jaded folks in every industry and every field, and that includes orchestras. But I think it really has to do with the leadership. It has to do with the culture that's set. And you know, there are. Maybe kind of as a roundabout way of answering the question, I realized very early on that if I went into a rehearsal just kind of blank, that the rehearsal could go well, the rehearsal could go not well, could be whatever. But I found really, really early on that like the worst days that I was having often led to the best rehearsals. Because I was cognizant of having been in the middle of a crappy day and knew full well that if I got in front of an orchestra with that attitude, that the rehearsal would go nowhere. And now instead of one person having a crappy day, there's 101 people that are having a crappy day. So it really has to do with the energy that you bring. So on the worst days that I've had, before I go on the podium, it's like, okay, this is what has to happen. And this is what has to happen right now. I had within the last few weeks, a meeting that I was not particularly looking forward to. And I made the very conscious decision at the right from the outset of that meeting, that I would do nothing but bring positive energy the whole meeting long, big smiles, big energy, all the rest. So I know that's not exactly answering the question, but it does come from the person at the top, because you cannot rely on a group of 100 people to give you energy. It doesn't work that way. Yeah. So those, because those 100 people have all had different experiences, all that, and some of them have had crappy days too. Some of them have had great days, but the energy that the person that's running the show, that's running the rehearsal, brings is everything. And I think if you get enough of those days of positive energy and good progress in a row, it helps people unjade themselves. Yeah. Some people are unjadeable, but you can get to some of them.
I think that's a great point. Managing the energy in yourself, if you want to even have a glimmer of trying to manage the energy of others. Brett, as we finish up, is there anything you'd like to leave our audience with, whether it be a thought or a challenge or, what you're focused on?
You know, I read a ton, as I'm sure we all do. And I've had more time to read in the last 6 months. It's been unbelievable. And one of the things that I've been rereading is the Marcus Aurelius Meditations, which of course are some of the greatest wisdom known to man. That's the edition that I have.
Yeah.
But there's a great book, I'm sure many of you may have heard of it, by Ryan Holiday, that came out a few years ago, called The Obstacle is the Way, which is drawn directly from Aurelius's Meditations. And I'll just share with you the quote that I keep coming back to over and over again as we all go through this, and it's very short. Our actions may be impeded, but there can be no impeding our intentions or dispositions, because we can accommodate and adapt. The mind adapts and converts to its own purposes the obstacle to our acting. The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. And that's, if that's not resiliency, adaptability, and reinvention, I don't know what is. And that has helped me immeasurably over the last 6 months. I hope it offers something to you too.
So well said. Brett, thank you for being on with us today. As always, appreciate all your gifts.
Thank you. And I appreciate you having me, and look forward to chatting again very soon.